Hi, Undisclosed listeners, Rabia here. Now, before we get into this week's bonus episode where we answer all the questions that remain about what's going to happen with Adnan's case and this new appeal ruling, I have a little favor to ask you. For the last 3 years, we have been raising money for Adnan's legal defense at launchgood.com/freeAdnan. Now, if you go to that website, you'll see it looks like we've raised a substantial amount of money, but the truth is we've actually spent almost all of it on legal fees in the past 3 years because, well, it's been a busy few years in court. So, we know we have a fight ahead of us and we need to continue to raise legal fees. So if you can give something, anything, 10, 15, 20 bucks, 100 bucks, whatever it is you can afford, we would really appreciate it and it would go a long way. So once again, that website is www.launchgood.com/freeAdnan. Thanks so much. Hi, and welcome to Undisclosed. This is our second bonus episode that we're doing just to update you on recent developments in the case of the state versus Adnan Syed. This is Rabia Chaudhry. I'm an attorney and author, and I'm here with my colleague, Colin Miller.
Hi, this is Colin Miller. I'm an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and I blog at Evidence Prof Blog.
We also have a special guest with us this week, and that is attorney Erica Souter. Erica Souter is a post-conviction and appellate criminal defense attorney practicing throughout Maryland and Washington, D.C. She blogs on the subject at MarylandPostConviction.com, and since establishing her firm in 2011, the life sentences of 10 of her clients have been modified or vacated. Welcome to the show, Erica.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Thanks for being here.
Now, as we noted in our first update episode, on March 29th, the Court of Special Appeals in Maryland affirmed Judge Welch's order granting Adnan a new trial. So the question that follows is, what happens next? Well, the state has 30 days to file what's known as a motion for reconsideration with the Court of Special Appeals, meaning there's a deadline of April 30th. There are four possible grounds that the state could move for reconsideration on. One, if the Court of Special Appeals' opinion didn't address a material, factual, or legal matter raised by Judge Welch. Two, if a material change in the law occurred after the case was submitted and was not addressed. Three, if a significant consequence of the decision wasn't addressed in the opinion. And four, if the opinion by the Court of Special Appeals conflicts with prior precedent by the Supreme Court, the Court of Appeals of Maryland, or the Court of Special Appeals of Maryland.
Here, COSA addressed every issue, the Court of Special Appeals, and there was no change in the law. It doesn't conflict with any precedent. There don't seem to be any unaddressed concerns. So if the state brings a motion to reconsider, it's almost certain to fail. But if the state doesn't file a motion to reconsider by April 30th, COSA will issue its mandate, which would mean that the state would have until May 15th to file a petition for writ of certiorari with the Court of Appeals of Maryland, which is the state Supreme Court. If the state does file a motion for reconsideration, that deadline would probably be pushed back a few weeks. Within 15 days of the state filing, the defense would then have 15 days to cross-petition on the cell tower claim and or the plea bargain claim, and I can assure you they surely will. The point of these petitions is to convince the Court of Appeals to take the appeal, because a court actually doesn't have to hear either appeal. In fact, in most cases, it doesn't allow appeals. In criminal cases in 2014, the Court of Appeals granted 12.3% of cert petitions. In 2015, it was 9.2%. And in 2016, it was 10.5%. But those numbers might be largely meaningless because only about 1% of Court of Special Appeal cases have a dissent. And a dissent greatly increases the odds that cert will be granted. Now, Colin did some research on this and found that in the last 10 reported criminal cases by the Court of Special Appeals, in which there was a dissenting opinion, the Court of Appeals granted cert in 8 of them.
So what does it take for the Court of Appeals to grant cert and hear an appeal? There are 7 active judges on the Court of Appeals. It usually takes 3 of those 7 judges voting to hear the appeal for cert to be granted and for the court to take the case. If for some reason 2 or more judges recuse themselves based on things like conflict of interest, it would only take 2 judges to grant cert. So let's break down the scenarios. First, it's unlikely, but the state could decide not to appeal to the Court of Appeals, which would mean that Judge Welch's order granting a new trial would take effect, and the state would then either re-prosecute, drop the case, or try to negotiate a plea deal with the defense. Second, which is far more likely, if the state tries to appeal and the Court of Appeals denies cert, The state would then have 90 days to file a petition for writ of certiorari with the United States Supreme Court, which is even less likely to hear the case. Assuming the Supreme Court denies the cert petition, again, Judge Welch's order granting a new trial would take effect. Third, let's say the Court of Appeals of Maryland decides to grant cert. There would then be a new round of briefs by both sides and oral arguments to be held before all the judges this fall. Now, unlike the oral arguments at the Court of Special Appeals, these oral arguments would be live streamed, meaning any of you as listeners could tune in and watch the oral arguments live. The Court of Appeals of Maryland would then have to issue its opinion by August 31st, 2019. At this point, once again, the losing party would then have 90 days to file a petition for writ of certiorari with the United States Supreme Court. So the question then becomes, will the state in this case seek to appeal? In an interview with Baynard Woods, the day after the opinion was issued, Thiru Vignaraja commented that, quote, the office is reviewing the decision that just came out yesterday to determine what's an appropriate next step. So, Eric, I guess we'll pose a couple of questions to you as the post-conviction guru in Maryland. First, in terms of that motion for reconsideration with the Court of Special Appeals, what's the likelihood that you think that the state files one of those?
I mean, I suppose it's always possible, but I would not expect that the state would file that motion for reconsideration. I think it's sort of a waste of time.
And that's because looking at those four grounds we discussed, you don't think there's really merit to any of those grounds for relief?
I think that's right. And I think they just sort of would want to move the case forward, and the next logical place to go would be to seek cert in the Court of Appeals. I mean, they could do it, but it would feel, I think, more of a delay. And there's one other thing. If the Court of Appeals denied cert, they could also file a motion to reconsider that denial of cert grant, too, which would be acted upon very quickly. It wouldn't take up that much more time in the process, but they would have that option.
I mean, to me, I feel like it would strategically, why wouldn't they delay? I mean, just by filing it, adding a few more months or whatever it is, I feel like that is part of the strategy, not just in this case, but I think this happens a lot in a lot of cases. People just file appeals, the state files appeals. It doesn't take a lot for them to do it, right? I mean, it doesn't take a lot of time, money, effort. They just keep kicking the can down the road. And I think that is part of, I just don't see the reason they wouldn't want to delay further.
Right. I mean, this case, I think, is unique in my experience sort of with the appellate stage of post-conviction practice, the state filing a motion. And this is just sort of anecdotal. I don't have a control group or something that I'm looking at. But I think typically they wouldn't file that motion to reconsider. It wouldn't result in much more than a delay. But, you know, depending on the optics that they're concerned about, it's certainly possible. And there isn't a downside for them to file a motion to reconsider.
And then, so Erica, you said you think it's pretty unlikely that the state files this motion to reconsider with the Court of Special Appeals. In terms of that cert petition to the Court of Appeals in Maryland, what's the likelihood that you think that the state files one of those?
I would be surprised if they didn't file it, given the posture of the case and given the state's sort of consistent position all along. I think that it's I would be surprised if they didn't. I think it's very likely that they will file the cert petition.
And then we laid out, you know, generally speaking, pretty low odds of a cert petition being granted. But then conversely, in cases of a criminal nature that are reported with a dissent, it seems quite a high rate that we have these cert petitions being granted. Do you have any sense of what the odds are that the Court of Appeals will grant cert in this case?
I mean, I always find it fascinating to see, because sort of when you're in the middle of it and practicing, I don't often have the opportunity to step back and look at the statistics. You're just sort of more concerned with your own individual case. So the statistics that you guys were talking about are really interesting to me. I think, so yeah, of course, it's unlikely in general that a cert petition is ever granted statistically. I think, I don't have a good grip on the numbers, but in this particular case, I think it's likely that the Court of Appeals would grant cert because it's a reported opinion, because there is a dissent. I think we can't talk about this case without talking about the public interest in it. And then I think also because the majority opinions talked about the fact that there was no Maryland case exactly on point with regard to failure to investigate in the context of an ineffective assistance of counsel claim. Whenever you hear there's no Maryland case on this, that's sort of a red flag that the Court of Appeals, who's interested in making law, might be interested in the case.
And I guess the last question I have is, assuming the Court of Appeals does grant the state cert petition, Do you see any real chance that they don't allow the defense to appeal the cell tower ruling, or do you think there's a possibility they could allow the alibi appeal but not the cell tower appeal?
I think it's possible that they could allow the alibi and not grant a cross application for cert on the cell tower issue. I think that's possible. Well, I mean, I guess depending on a number of factors, the alibi issue, I think in the Court of Special Appeals, I was looking back and looking at my notes from oral argument, and it was so clear that's what the Court of Special Appeals was interested in. As far as the waiver issue, it's interesting, and of course the court can always excuse waiver with regard to the cell tower, but I think one thing that I thought was interesting in the Court of Special Appeals opinion was they were saying that an argument wasn't made below in the post-conviction court that the court could simply excuse waiver. And I wonder if, you know, I wonder how that would factor in if that argument is lost or if he can go ahead and make that argument at any time since the court has the power to excuse it at any time. I'm not as convinced that they would be interested in the waiver issue as they would be in the alibi issue.
It's not often that Susan, Colin, and I actually get together in the same space because, as many of you know, we kind of record from our own spaces. Once in a while, we do have to come together to do some investigating. And next month, we're coming together for a very exciting event, CrimeCon. Susan, Colin, and I will be presenting at CrimeCon, which will be held from May 4th to May 6th in Nashville, Tennessee. We'll be at the Gaylord Opryland together on a panel to give a great talk about the case of the state versus Adnan Syed, about everything that's happened since Serial, about our own investigation and what we've uncovered. And we'll also be there to meet other folks interested in the case, to meet other podcasters, to meet other people who work in true crime. We're going to be giving our talk on Saturday, May 5th at 1 p.m. It's going to be called Undisclosed, Undoing a Conviction. And then at 2 o'clock, we're going to be having a meet and greet. So don't miss out. For more information, go to crimecon.com. See you guys in Nashville. So let's now pivot to some listener questions. And we've gotten dozens, if not hundreds of them. Many of them are kind of, you know, the same question posed by different listeners. So please don't mind if we don't read your exact question, but we're going to try to cover the entire range of the kinds of questions posed to us. So this question comes to us from Heather Schinner, and she says, as excited as I am to hear this, is anyone working on catching the real killer? I would like the Lees to get justice as well. So I'll respond to this. I get this question a lot, especially when I speak to audiences about the case. And I find it really interesting that people expect a defense team to be doing the work of the state, because catching a killer is the job of the police. It is not the job of defense counsel for a defendant who's been wrongfully convicted. It's not the job of that wrongfully convicted person. Having said that, the state really does have in its power to drop the charges, reopen the investigation. Maybe if they still have the DNA evidence, you know, pull it up, like actually try to figure out what happened to him and Lee. And that is the outcome that I hope for the most. Now, beyond that, there has been an investigative team that we have not reported on at all for the last couple of years working behind the scenes and also looking for leads. But again, it's very hard if you don't have like subpoena powers and other police powers to do the kind of investigation that the police themselves could do. So really, that's their job. You guys want to add anything?
Yeah, I think that makes sense. The police aren't going to do anything until this is finalized. Right now, it's still being appealed. And until this case is ended, we're not going to have the police looking for anyone else as being the perpetrator.
Yeah. And I also think, by the way, I mean, I get this question too, it's kind of related, is that if Adnan goes to trial and is acquitted, which I believe if he goes to trial, he would be, would they then look for an alternate suspect, try to prosecute somebody else? As far as I know, that is unlikely to happen. Erica, do you know how often that happens? If a person is acquitted of a crime, then the police then continue to investigate and find somebody else. I think they kind of end it there, right?
Right. I'm unaware of a circumstance, let's say in one of my cases, where they then sort of reopened and pursued an alternate suspect. I mean, I think the other scenario, and a lot of what sort of prompts this question, is when the Innocence Project is working on cases, a lot of times they may identify another suspect in order to exonerate whoever was wrongfully convicted. And so they sort of go in hand to the state with the confession of the person who actually did it or the DNA evidence that indicates that this other person actually did it. But it's important to remember, and I think, I mean, and this sort of goes back to your original point, Robbie, that it's not a defendant's job to identify an alternate suspect, although it's certainly useful if you can do that. And that at this stage of the game, sifting through the evidence is important for evaluating the impact of the particular error that the defendant's asserting, but he is not tasked with proving that he's innocent by way of identifying another suspect. He's just sort of showing what could have happened if, you know, a particular mistake couldn't have been made. But this is, so for an example, in Maryland, we do have something called the petition for writ of actual innocence, but that's not the procedural posture that we're in right now.
This next question comes from Katie. Her Twitter handle is @KateEmily21. And she asks, what's a dissenting opinion? Does it always have to be written, or is it only written when it's a split decision? Could Justin challenge her on the basis of four irrelevant opinions? And so breaking that down, a dissenting opinion does not have to be written. Sometimes you have unanimous opinion where all the judges agree. Some other options you could have a concurring opinion where a judge agrees with the outcome and wants to emphasize a different point. You could have an opinion concurring in the judgment where a judge might reach the same result, but based upon different legal grounds. So you could have maybe a majority of the judges finding an equal protection violation, and another judge could concur in the judgment and say it's actually a due process violation. And what we have here is the dissenting opinion where we have the dissenting judge saying the two in the majority have decided there should be a new trial. My conclusion is there was not ineffective assistance of counsel, and so I dissent, meaning I reach a different outcome than the majority. So it doesn't have to be written. In most cases, it's not written, but in this case, we had a judge who disagreed with what the majority had to say. And the second part of the question is, can Justin challenge on the basis of four irrelevant opinions? That's going to be at the heart of the appeal in the Court of Appeals in Maryland, should they take the case, is that Judge Grafe, in her dissent, cites these four opinions to essentially try to argue there could have been grounds here for Gutierrez not to contact Asia McClain, and there's some precedent to support it. And I think there are grounds to distinguish all four of those cases, but I can see the state trying to argue that they apply. And I think the heart of oral arguments are going to be, you know, if we break all this down, are there reasonable reasons why we think that Gutierrez might not have contacted Asia McClain? I think the answer is no, but there is some precedent out there that obviously the dissent is cited in favor of the state.
Erica, can I ask what you thought about the dissenting opinion?
It was interesting reading her opinion, having watched sort of, she was, I think, the most engaged in, or one of the
she
most
was.
Engaged in oral argument. And I was looking back over my notes about that. I think ultimately those, and Colin wrote a piece about this. I think each of those cases is sort of factually distinguishable. If the question is, when is it ever appropriate to not investigate, I can, I guess, in theory, come up with a scenario where maybe the person seems so utterly not credible that you make a decision not to pursue it further. But I feel as if there's always a requirement to do a little bit more digging to make that credibility assessment. So personally, I wasn't persuaded by the dissent. Of course, I'm coming into it with my own particular bias as a defense attorney. And I think ultimately, I don't have a crystal ball, but if the Court of Appeals did grant cert, I think that they would ultimately agree with the Court of Special Appeals decision, which I think was a well-reasoned decision, the majority. But it just seems like I'm very troubled by the idea that any defendant would bring an alibi to their attorney, an alibi witness, and you wouldn't take the steps to look into it further. And I mean, the other thing to think about is, although, you know, Judge Grafe spoke a lot about, you know, the potential reasons why a lawyer might make a strategic decision not to investigate an alibi witness, And it's also speculative, which is always sort of the devil in post-conviction work, is that it involves a lot of speculation. But you have to be mindful that, like, not any strategic reason will do. It has to be a sound, objectively reasonable strategic decision. There is an objective standard that we're supposed to look to, not just the personal. A lawyer could have a strategy, and it could be objectively unreasonable. So the assertion that it is strategic, that it was a purposeful choice, doesn't insulate it from holding it against an objective standard and deciding whether or not it was deficient performance.
I have a question about that, you know, strategy that or whatever strategic decision an attorney might be using. Should there not be any evidence of that strategic decision? How does that work? I mean, for example, if you comb through the defense files and you find that there's no memo, there's no notation, there's no record of a conversation with another attorney or a law clerk saying that, yeah, I don't think that's a good idea. If there's absolutely no evidence that the decision was strategic, then how is that even evaluated? I mean, other than it being like some of the cases that were cited in the dissent, it was almost so obvious why an attorney wouldn't contact. I mean, like, you know, like a person is giving their third possible alibi for that night. Okay, then it becomes kind of obvious what right. The strategy might be. But in a situation like this, where it just seems like it's just out of thin air that we're making, like, or the dissent is making an assumption that maybe there was a strategy. It doesn't seem like it's enough without any evidence.
Well, so it's important to keep in mind the burden of persuasion, right? So in the same way that theoretically a defendant is presumed innocent, you know, until proven guilty, and it's the state's burden of persuasion at a criminal trial, the lawyer in post-conviction is presumed competent, and it's up to the petitioner to move that needle. So all things being equal, with no record, with no testimony, there's a presumption that the lawyer made a competent strategic decision. And that's why, you know, sort of in the absence of anything else, just like sort of the way that a defense attorney will say, my client doesn't have to prove anything, my client can not say a word, and he's still, that's not his burden, he's presumed innocent. In the same way, the lawyer doesn't have to, or the state doesn't have to demonstrate that it's strategic necessarily. But there is some case law that says you can't just sort of pull reasons out of thin air. There is a court of special appeals opinion in a post-conviction case where the lawyer testified that he simply couldn't remember his reason for, in that instance, it was failing to request an instruction on a lesser included offense. And the state said, well, maybe the lawyer's reason was that he wanted an all or nothing verdict and he didn't want a compromised verdict. So he didn't offer that. He didn't request that. But because the lawyer said he couldn't remember in that instance, the post-conviction court said, we don't have evidence that the reason that the state's asserting is what his reason was, and that the state can't just sort of speculate as to the reason. So at least with regard to that case, which I actually cited to when I had a deceased attorney that I was post-convicting, it seems like there's at least some case law that suggests we shouldn't just sort of pull the reasons out of thin air.
Okay. So when you said that, you know, there's a, in the same way defendant has a, you know, he's presumed innocent, an attorney is presumed competent unless proven otherwise, I just want to remind our listeners, our audience, that in this case, during the hearings in front of Judge Welch, we were not allowed to introduce evidence. Defense was not allowed to introduce evidence about Christina Gutierrez's health and kind of what was happening to her at the time that would even bring before the court any kind of challenge to her competency. So in this vacuum, yes, but in reality, no, everybody knows. I mean, all the entire legal community in Maryland knows really what happened with Christina Gutierrez in those last 4 or 5 years of her practice and her life. So that's just so divorced from reality. But one thing I do want to note is this. It's interesting to me that, you know, we're talking about her strategic reasons, but one of the facts that kind of never gets any oxygen on this issue is that Christina actually told Adnan that she did check Asia out. When I first spoke to him that the night he was convicted, he said to me, there is this girl, Christina Gutierrez told me, my attorney told me, that she did talk to her and checked her out, and it didn't check out. Her alibi didn't check out. So she actually, and you know, of course, other than him telling me and me having that information from 2000 and, you know, Adnan himself actually asserting that at that time, we don't have evidence that she said that to him. But wouldn't that, if an attorney does that, what is that? If an attorney just lies to a client like that, how can that factor legally into any of this? Other than like a misconduct complaint, like a ethical complaint.
Right. I mean, I think I actually blogged about that particular fact as being one of the disturbing facts to me, that a lawyer might affirmatively misrepresent her case preparation to a client, because she could have said to him, and sort of taking the assertion at face value, and of course there are going to be some people who doubt that the exchange ever took place, that one, that she misrepresented it, and then later after his conviction that she admitted that she never contacted her. We certainly know from Asia, and I think the court found it credible, that nobody in fact contacted her. So I think there are a couple of ways to look at it. One, maybe she didn't have a strategy, and that's why she didn't tell him, I've chosen to not look into that further because I don't think that's where we need to focus, and I don't think that is what's going to move the needle.
Yeah.
Or is she managing her client through a deceptive means because, you know, she needs to focus him, and so she's not going to give any weight to his assertion because she thinks it's silly and it doesn't go anywhere, and she's just going to lie to him in order to manage him. And obviously that's would be very unethical. And I don't, you know, anyone who's been a lawyer has had a client that they find difficult, but she certainly would have an obligation to be honest. And I think it's certainly arguable that it weighs on the side that maybe there wasn't a strategy, because why couldn't she simply articulate that strategy to her client?
Right. Well, Adnan actually had filed a complaint with the Attorney Grievance Commission afterwards, and it was dismissed. So anyway, moving on. Thank you so much for answering. I'll pose the next question, and that is by CJ, and Twitter handle is at CJ13TWT. The question is, there might still be another trial, so at any point can the state decide not to pursue?
Yeah, well, I can just say quickly, yeah. I mean, they could decide at this moment we're not going to appeal the Court of Special Appeals ruling and we're not going to re-prosecute, and that would be the end of the day. So starting today, they could simply decide we're not going forward.
And if they did that, that would mean, what, dropping charges or just negotiating a plea deal immediately or something like that, right?
They could, or they could simply decide there's not enough evidence here and we're going to drop the issue. I mean, if the state decides not to appeal, Judge Welch's order vacating the conviction goes into effect, meaning there's no pending charges, and the state could simply decide we're not going to bring new charges. Now, of course, they could also bring charges and then negotiate a plea deal, or they could take it back to trial. But yeah, today they could simply decide we're not going to appeal, we're not going to bring new charges, and that would be the end of the day.
And Erica, who in this, when we say the state, who would be making this decision? Is this the prosecutor, Vigna Raja? And also, he's a private attorney now. He's not with the Attorney General's office. So who's really making this decision?
So I would say the Attorney General's office is in the driver's seat as far as whether or not to seek cert, whether or not to pursue a trial or offer a deal or enter nolle prosequi to the charges, which just means they would be choosing not to prosecute. That would be up to the state's attorney's office. And just to give a bit of specific kind of context, I had a case in Baltimore City where we won on post-conviction, and this is recently, like within the last year, and the client's charges were vacated. The state filed an application for leave to appeal. The Court of Special Appeals granted the application and reversed the award of relief as to all but one charge. So one charge remained vacated. Mm. That decision was issued in July. We were back in court in Baltimore City by January 2nd.
On a new trial.
Right. And what happened, though, was that the state ultimately offered a deal. I mean, it would have been a day of like preliminaries and seeing sort of what's the time date, well, and how long would this trial last and who's it going to go to. But ultimately, the state made an offer that we accepted that was put on the record that day. So at any time, the state's attorney's office could, you could be mid-trial and the state could choose to not go forward, depending on what happened. I mean, they sort of have all the power in determining if they wanted to make an offer or if they decided that the case was not going in a direction and they wanted to not go any further.
So So another question that gets posed a lot is this next one by Lex, whose handle is at Lex Thorl. So does this mean he is getting out or no? And a lot of folks have asked this question about, okay, so the convictions have been vacated. Why isn't he out? And can he apply for bail? Well, the conviction has been vacated, but the charges stand against him, as far as I know. And until this is final, at least, or even after it's final, I mean, he is somebody who's been going to be facing murder one charges if the state can actually take him to trial. The charges stand. It's not that the charges have been dropped, but the convictions have been vacated right now. He actually can apply for bail again, and we applied for bail before. Judge Welch at the time denied that application, not based on the merits of the application. In fact, he said that he specifically found that Adnan is not a danger to anyone. But what he said was basically that the appeal is pending right now, so we have to like wait until that's decided. So I don't know exactly how it works. Maybe we go back to him, although he's retired, but assuming, I mean, we go back to him and renew the bail application, say, well, the appeal's been decided. But if the state does file an application for cert, that might be another reason that, again, it's not granted. But then at the end of the day, if the state doesn't apply for cert or if the court appeal denies the cert, Adnan would be like a man facing first degree murder charges. And in that situation, I don't think it's that likely for him to get bail anyway. So he could apply for bail again. It's unlikely he'll get it, I think, is where we're at.
I think that's true. I think it would be extremely unlikely that he would get bail, certainly while this case is going through. If the Court of Appeals granted cert and if it were pending, I think it's very unlikely that he would get bail. I think if he were in retrial posture, the odds are, so say the state doesn't file cert or cert is granted and the decision, you know, they affirm the decision of the Court of Special Appeals. And so he's in retrial posture, pending whatever the state does, either pursue the case or make an offer or whatever. His odds of getting bail, I think, are a little higher once he's in that posture, if we're sort of looking at where would be the greatest chances. And even then, he might not get bail, but I think his chances would be better in retrial than when it's pending before the Court of Special Appeals or the Court of Appeals.
Our next question comes from William Whitlock. His handle is at WTWhitlock5, and he asks, any timetable on when the decision will be made if the state is going to appeal? I'm hoping no appeal and you guys can move forward toward the next trial. And so the answer here is, if the state does not file a motion for reconsideration, then we're going to know by May 15th whether they have filed a cert petition with the Court of Appeals in Maryland. If they do file a motion to reconsider, that's going to push that back probably at least a few weeks. And then, Erica, do you have a sense of how long it generally takes from the filing of a cert petition before the Court of Appeals makes its decision to grant or deny cert?
It's relatively quick. I think I read somewhere on the Court of Appeals website that it's 6 to 8 weeks. Generally, they try to act on a cert petition. As to whether or not they're going to grant it, meaning that they set it in as a regular appeal and then a longer timetable spins out, or deny it. So the decision that they make about that cert petition will happen a little faster than a lot of the other things that have happened in the case.
Okay, so we're looking maybe around May 15th to see whether the state appeals, and then maybe around July 15th to decide whether Court of Appeals grants cert.
The headlines are coming fast and furious out of this White House, but you don't have to get lost in them. Join us as we go beyond, way beyond the headlines on the 45th podcast. Find us and subscribe on iTunes. The 45th podcast, three voices, three points of view, and a deep dive on policy and politics like you have never heard before.
So here's where it gets even dicier for Manafort and why he is screwed and going to get indicted like he's been saying.
So are you saying Planned Parenthood is as dangerous as the NRA?
Well, if you view unborn babies as life, then yeah.
You're a Southerner,
yes.
Traitor.
Yes, and I don't want my heritage associated with like veneration of genocide.
You know, imposing and infringing the rights of people to own property is something that I'm against. And as well as I'm against the government telling its people what to purchase and what not to purchase.
How do you feel about marijuana?
About marijuana? Legalize it.
All right, at least you're consistent.
All right, so Ashley Peterson, whose handle is at Ashley P, I guess, was wondering if the state has the ability to contact Jay at this point. Can they change the story again when this goes back to trial, this time fixing what they can of the cell tower ping problems, or do they have to stick to testimony already given? Yeah, no, they don't have to actually stick to anything that was presented at the first trial. Having said that, if they completely change, if Jay testifies again or other witnesses testify again and their testimony is completely different, I believe they can be impeached using prior testimony. But the state certainly can, and I think in the opinion, it was specifically addressed this issue of the state trying to change the timeline. They said, well, you can't do that now. You could do it if you go back to trial, but you're kind of locked in now. So the state could certainly try it. I think it's unlikely to be successful, though. You guys want to?
Well, I think you're correct as far as the state could come up with a new theory, but everything that happened beforehand doesn't just disappear. So right. If a witness has... if a state's witness has a completely different story, then, you know, I'm quite sure that the defense will be at the ready to impeach with all of the contradictions, which would further damage their credibility.
Erica, a follow-up question to that. Jay actually gave a very lengthy interview to The Intercept a couple of years ago in which his story changed significantly. And people have posed the question, can that be used if he were to testify again to impeach him, or can you not use that because it's not something he said under oath?
Well, it would be hearsay, but it would be a prior inconsistent statement, which is an exception. Well, actually, Colin can probably speak to this better than I can, but certainly if he made some sort of out-of-court statement that was inconsistent, I think that it could be used to impeach him.
Yeah, so that would be exactly. It's hearsay, so it's not admissible to prove the truth of the matter asserted. So, for instance, when he said the burial was closer to midnight, you can't use that at a new trial to say the burial was closer to midnight. What you can do is you can say, Jay, you have testified at this third trial now that the burial was in the 7 o'clock hour, assuming he's doing that to correspond with the pings. Isn't it true that in an interview with The Intercept, you made a statement that the burial was closer to midnight? And that can be used to show the contradiction between this out-of-court statement and the in-court testimony to call into question his credibility. Our next question is from Maria Goll. At Maria Goll, and she asks, is there a decent chance they'd opt to basically credit him for time served rather than concede and not move forward with another trial? My inclination here is absolutely. I think that based upon some of the issues that have cropped up and issues such as Jay changing his story again, I think there's a pretty high chance they'll at least offer a plea deal of a guilty plea with time served. I'm not sure if they go for an Alford plea or a nolo contendere plea, but I think they would offer a guilty plea for time served rather than going to trial.
And also, I mean, like, you know, right now in Maryland, very slowly, juvenile sentences, juveniles who got life sentences, those cases are being reviewed. And in some of my conversations with Adnan, he did say, you know, if we were to get back to a trial position where the state has to consider whether or not to take him to trial, at that point, he probably, and we're talking about maybe another couple of years, but at that point, he probably already has the time served. I mean, if his sentence were modified based on the modifications they're doing for juvenile sentences, he already probably would have met that threshold too. So if he went to trial and the state got a life sentence, again, if they won, they got a life sentence, and the judge is considering what to sentence him when he, having committed a crime as a juvenile, he probably still would just walk because he served most of that sentence already under these new, like the sentencing structure that they're looking at for juveniles. So it doesn't seem like it makes any sense for the state to pursue a trial and waste a lot of time and money when at the end of the day, it's not like they're going to add a lot more years to his sentence. All right, so the next question is from Carla Murphy. Her handle is @Murphy_CJ. What happens next? Rabia, will you be allowed into the trial? Who will be representing Adnan? Truth Justice Pod, Bob Ruff, will you give them the Don theory? Where is Jay? When will the trial be? Oh boy, can Adnan come home on bail? Okay, we've answered some of those. Will I be allowed into the trial? So I was sequestered during the PCR hearing because the prosecutor said that he might be calling me, which I knew he wasn't going to. But anyway, could I be sequestered during the trial? I can't imagine unless for some reason the state or defense thinks I could be a witness somehow. And I have never had any connection to the facts of the actual case, like the actual underlying crime. I've never had. So I can't imagine in what capacity I could be a witness. And barring that, I see no reason they could keep me out of court. Yes? No, guys?
I think that's right. So your relationship to the case on post-conviction is very different than right. your relationship to the case at trial. So although there may have been a particular kind of tactic to have you excluded from the post-conviction hearing, I agree with you. I don't think the same reasons would apply at trial, given your relationship to the facts in that case, or lack thereof.
Yeah. Who will be representing Adnan? I mean, I'm assuming that Justin will team up with a fantastic trial attorney and they'll tackle it together, giving the truth. I mean, Bob Ruff, will you give them the Dawn theory? I give who, how, where? I don't know if that's something we can address. Where is Jay? I think people know where Jay is. Certainly the report of The Intercept found him. I know where he is. And if obviously it goes back to trial, he will have to return to Maryland probably and testify.
Next question is by Zeke Farrow at Zekeness. He asks, when do we get to hear the secret weapon evidence at Mr. John Cryer Stillhounds at Evidence Prof about? The answer is, if this goes to a new trial, you'll certainly hear about it because I assume it would be used at a new trial. Barring that, no guarantees. It'll probably remain secret. That there might be something in the somewhat near future that reveals some of these secrets, but we'll just have to wait and see.
Oh my gosh, you're breaking hearts, Colin. This is what I say. I say if it doesn't go to trial, if it's resolved and Adnan comes home, one way or the other, it's time to just put it all out there. I think, if it's not used at trial and there's no trial and he gets a plea deal or whatever it is, or they drop charges and he comes home, there's no reason not to let folks know. This is some of the stuff that we found. It wasn't useful, but, I want our listeners to keep hope alive. From Ryan Oppenshaw, whose Twitter handle is at Ryan Macko, did you need to win on the Tower Point to raise it at the retrial? No.
Nope. And in fact, the interesting thing is the Court of Special Appeals didn't reverse Judge Welch on the merits of the cell charge claim. They found it was waived, but his ruling stands. Either way, it doesn't matter. We could have the Frye hearing, a hearing to determine the admissibility of expert evidence, and a disclaimer could be used to show this is unreliable. That might work or not. If it doesn't, you could still use that disclaimer at trial to cross-examine any cell tower expert the state might call.
All right. So the next question is from Bethany Lank at B_Lank. What is the cost of this case? I have no idea what the state has spent on this case so far. I mean, but I can tell you that Adnan's defense over all of these years, it's been 19 years now, has run probably around $1 million so far, considering all the different stages. And he only had a public defender for a very, very short time. But other than that, so it's always private attorneys and we continue to pay legal fees. So
and the next question comes from Richard Aldridge, Twitter handle at R Aldridge. Can they offer an Alford plea at this stage? And if they do, what's the likelihood it would be accepted? And again, yeah, absolutely. The state could offer an Alford plea to time served. Again, an Alford plea is a plea where, legally speaking, the defendant pleads guilty, but the defendant maintains their innocence while acknowledging there's enough evidence there that a jury could convict. And Ravi, I mean, this is, you probably have a much better sense than I do about whether Adnan and Justin would accept that offer or would hold out.
We actually haven't had a conversation. Like, we really haven't discussed this. Like, I guess it's a cross that bridge when we get to it type of thing. Almost like we never discussed filing for bail until Judge Welch, vacated the charges. And it was like, oh, gosh, we got to make this decision. I don't know. I just honestly don't know where. Of course, it comes down to Adnan, but I'm sure he'll be in consultation with his family. I mean, if it was my advice would be come home. Take the plea, come home. I think that is what happens in many of these cases. I mean, it happened in the West Memphis 3 case. It's just the common. It's more common unless we're able to fully exonerate him and something drastic happens in the next couple of years. That would be my advice to him. But at the end of the day, I don't know what he would want to do. I do believe that when a person is able to secure their freedom, that it makes it easier for them to also work towards an exoneration down the road.
And Erica, to the extent that this doesn't violate attorney-client privilege or confidentiality, have you ever been involved with a case either in a pretrial or post-conviction posture where an Alford plea has been a consideration?
Usually so if we're resolving some post-conviction case, it's usually not through an Alford plea. It's usually through a straight plea. The other thing, and this happens with clients a lot when they come to me and they say, well, I had an Alford plea, and isn't that different than a guilty plea? And it's different in the sense that, yes, you're not admitting guilt, but legally, sort of how the legal system treats it, it's functionally the same as a guilty plea. So there's the record of the plea, but for example, when you look it up in KSearch, it just says guilty. It doesn't typically say Alford plea. So it is treated the same in terms of what you have, in terms of what your rights are. For example, in Maryland, with a petition for writ of actual innocence, the court has actually recently held in a couple of opinions that you cannot file a petition for writ of actual innocence if you have pled guilty. It's treated the same. And so I've certainly had cases where clients, you know, we've gotten post-conviction relief, or I've negotiated with the state and we've agreed to resolve the case through reducing the sentence and the charges remaining the same. And I think it's difficult sometimes for the public who have not been through this to understand sort of what the calculation is and how important it is to just be able to get home and get to your family and be out of prison. And the practicality of that is such a compelling decision that a lot of clients just want to be free. They just want to be with their families, and they'll kind of do whatever's necessary in order to do that.
And this is a decision that the district attorney's office would make. So, for example, right now it's Marilyn Mosby, but there is an election coming up in November. And in fact, this prosecutor is running for that office along with one other candidate, Ivan Bates. You know, we don't know who at the end of the day would be tasked with making the decision, whether they offer an Alford plea or just a straight guilty plea if it comes to that. But I do feel that if it was Mosby or Mr. Bates, then they might be more willing to offer an Alford plea. And like you said, okay, I mean, fine, at the end of the day, it's still a guilty plea. But I do think it gives some measure of relief, satisfaction, something. It gives the defendant something, some measure of dignity, having maintained their innocence all these years.
Our next question is from Sperman1313 at Sperman1313, and they ask, am I understanding the order correctly that the new trial is based on the Asia McClain testimony and not the cell phone evidence? And that's 100% correct. Judge Welch, the circuit court judge, had decided, I'm going to grant a new trial on the cell tower evidence, the ineffective assistance claim, and not on the alibi ineffective assistance claim. And the Court of Special Appeals, in effect, reversed both of those, finding, I believe, there was ineffective assistance in connection with alibi witness Asia McClain. And again, they didn't disturb the factual findings or the legal findings regarding the merits of the cell tower claim. They simply reversed the reasoning on waiver and found that Adnan had waived this cell tower claim, and therefore they weren't allowed to reach it substantively.
So the next question comes from Hari Mohan, and his Twitter handle is at HariMohanWK. Pardon my ignorance on the ineffective assistance. Why try for a plea bargain when not guilty? And I think Hari is talking about the third issue that we really have not touched in a while now, but this opinion did address, and that is raising a claim of ineffective assistance of counsel that Gutierrez did not approach the state for a plea deal that Adnan had requested. So, you know, I actually wrote about this in the book, and it wasn't really talked about a lot in our podcast or even in Serial, I don't think. I can't remember. But while Adnan was in holding, while he was waiting to be tried, you know, what ends up happening, apparently, and I haven't experienced this, is that you end up getting a lot of advice from other people who are already also incarcerated and have been through the system. And he was told, and he's 17 years old, he's never been, you know, arrested before. He was told by multiple people who had been through the system many times that, listen, you should ask for a plea. You should find out if they're making an offer, because once they get you on murder one, if they make the arrest and they bring the charges, like, they've got something. They're going to, you know, your chances are not good. It is a rare for the state to lose these kinds of cases. And I think he was just, you know, so he, not knowing anything, I mean, he asked his attorney, and I don't think he did anything wrong. I think anybody in that position would at least be curious to know if there's an offer being made. Having said that, it is also not an unusual phenomenon for people who are innocent to take guilty pleas. This happens over and over. It's been documented. The New York Times, I think, did a really great investigative piece on this a couple years ago. It's not uncommon. I mean, and if you think about the rate of pleas in federal court, 97% of cases are resolved with a guilty plea. It's slightly lower in state courts, but it's still pretty high. And, you know, people just feel pressured to take a plea because they're afraid of what could happen if they go to trial. If you guys have anything else to add to that, the idea that only a guilty person would take a guilty plea is not exactly right.
Did he make bail pre-trial? He was incarcerated, right?
He did not make bail because a couple of reasons, I think. Number one, I think the court incorrectly, because his date of birth was wrong on the charging documents. They thought he was 18.
Right.
The court thought he was 18, and the state made that argument that he's a flight risk, basically.
Right. How could I forget that?
Yeah.
So I think that's a huge, important factor for people to remember is that I think if there have probably been studies about this, but a decision whether or not to take a plea is greatly influenced by whether or not you're in holding, because your perspective is different. Your fear is different. If you are able to go home and sleep in your own bed at night, it's still facing criminal charges is incredibly scary. But if you're locked up and you've already gotten a taste of what the future might look like, you know, your decision is different. And there have been, especially I think talking about cases in New York and Rikers Island and these cases being delayed and people being incarcerated pretrial, and then ultimately accepting guilty pleas for things that they didn't do just to make it stop, is incredibly common and not at all unreasonable, even if you are innocent. And then I think the other thing to just kind of give you a visual of what Baltimore City lockup is like when you're in pretrial. I mean, it's a bunch of guys in what looks like sort of an old-fashioned cell with iron bars, and they're all together. So there's definitely, you know, talking to pass the time because you might be there for a long time. So certainly, you know, people are talking about their experiences and offering probably solicited and unsolicited advice about what, you know, everybody should do. So certainly I think it's likely that you'd at least want to know if you have the option of pleading guilty to just sort of have some certainty about your future and the outcome.
Yeah, Adnan's attorneys who represented him at the bail hearing, Chris Floor and Doug Colbert, actually have repeatedly said that they really, really believe that if Adnan had been granted bail, the outcome of the trial even would have been different because he would have had the ability to help in his defense and nailing down his alibi and what he did that day. And they think that had a real impact on the outcome of this case. So,
yeah, the next question, I don't have the name listed in the document, but it asks, maybe the first dissent case given is to do with the prosecution claiming the public library does not equal the high school. Prosecution saying Adnan said he was at high school, so library alibi is not relevant. Is that similarity claimed in COSA dissent? And so this is referring to that first case cited by Judge Grafe in her dissent. And that was the case, as we noted in our first update episode, where the defendant had a job and he also resided at a rehab center. And so his alibi at trial was that he was at the job. And then he later claimed ineffective assistance, saying my lawyer should have investigated the rehab facility to determine that I had an alibi there. And yeah, Judge Grafe does touch upon this a bit. And of course, Judge Welch and the majority both noted this idea that technically the Woodlawn Public Library was not the high school, but constructively, it was on the same campus, generally speaking. It is right there in the same geographic area. And so I think the point we were trying to make, and I think the majority and Welch make as well, is that this really isn't different. It's not like that Broadnax case cited by the dissent where it's two fundamentally different locations claimed as the alibi.
And Adnan also testified at the first post-conviction hearing. And remember, before this, Adnan has never had an opportunity to testify. So the first post-conviction hearing, Adnan testified that he was at school and then he went to the library. It's not that he's never said that he went to the library. I mean, when he repeatedly insisted to his attorney, and it's reflected in her notes, okay, to check this out, that, you know, he remembers seeing Asia and his boyfriend there. This was the timing. He means at the library, not at any other part of the school is he talking about. So for him to say, you know, I don't know where in the record this is even coming from. To be honest, I don't know where in the record's coming from that Adnan ever committed to saying he was only at the high school excluding the library. So it's one thing to make the argument, well, the library is part of the high school, so he's good. But he's always said that, yeah, he went to the library. He regularly went to the library. So I don't really, even know where, even if you're going to make the argument, I'm like, where did that even come from? Adnan's never said that he did not go to the library.
And when Judge Graf was making that whole California argument during oral argument, where she was saying, you know,
right,
if a defendant alibi witness said they were in California, Judge Wright actually jumped in and pointed out that the library was 100 yards from where her alibi by habit was and that it wasn't California. So I think its proximity and sort of where it fits into the case was something that wasn't lost upon the judges in the Court of Special Appeals.
Yeah. Yeah, they seem to know the facts of the case quite well, in fact. So the next question is by Christy Hughes, and she says, if the state believes so strongly in Nansade's guilt, why don't they have the DNA testing done? This has always made me believe he's innocent and the state knows it. Seems malicious on the state's part. Well, I'll say this right now. There's absolutely no incentive for the state to do it. They have a conviction. Why would they upset it in any way? There's no advantage in them doing it right now. The real question for me is that why didn't they do it back in 1999? They had the DNA evidence then. Right now, we don't even know if it exists, but they had it then. And that's when they failed to or refused, not failed to, I think they actually actively refused to test it at the time. And I think that's even more highly suspicious and questionable than why they don't do it now. There's not a lot of reason for them to do it now. Now, if the case were to go back to trial, yeah, I think then they might have more incentive to do it. Or if they were considering what would be the next step, if they lose on all these, you know, on the cert and all the stuff, then maybe they'll consider it. But I don't know. What do you think, Erica?
Right. I think it makes sense that if it were going to happen, that it would happen either at, you know, the defense behest or, you know, maybe in retrial posture. But I can't imagine that they would ever do it now in the current posture. Just, you're right. I don't think they have incentive to do it. And I think, you know, it's always interesting to me. I think prosecutors often just view cases differently. And, you know, I've had cases where it seemed to me so sort of painfully honest that a defendant was innocent or, you know, that a conviction was unjust for some number of reasons. And the state just looked at it in an entirely different way that was difficult for me to understand. And so I think there's often a different mindset with prosecutors. And I don't imagine that testing the DNA is something that's on their radar at this stage.
Our next question is from Sierra Abernathy, and she asks, if the state decides not to retry Adnan and dismiss, assuming without prejudice, would Adnan be entitled to any compensation from the state if that is even available to the wrongfully convicted? He technically wouldn't have been found innocent, and the sentence is being vacated puts him back to the original position like the convictions never happened. Thank you for all of y'all's hard work. I'm a prosecutor, and I listen to y'all in Truth and Justice religiously so I can check myself and make sure no innocent people are convicted of crimes they did not commit. Now, Erica, correct me if I'm wrong, because I've been working on this in South Carolina a lot, compensate the wrongfully convicted. My understanding is it used to be that the only way you could get compensation under Maryland's law was if there was a finding of innocence by the governor. But I think last fall, there's a new law that took place in Maryland that says like there's a 10-person commission that makes that decision. Are you aware of the change in the law on that?
I am not, embarrassingly. Okay. I'm not aware of that.
That's my understanding, is it's a 10-member task force that now would look at the case and decide, is this a case of innocence, and that would allow for compensation. I'm not 100% sure, but that was what I seem to recall from my research.
And wouldn't there also be an avenue for a defendant in this kind of situation to sue the state?
Yeah, so that would be a lawsuit. It would be under 42 U.S. Code Section 1983. But that gets into issues of immunity and qualified immunity. And as the Sean Thomas case that Rabia covered so well on the podcast has shown, that's somewhat moving forward, but that's a pretty tough standard to meet to get compensation under the federal law. Our next question is from Annika Gillespie, and she asks, now that your podcast and Serial has made his case so well known, do you think that he will be able to get a fair trial this time around? Maybe that's a silly question, but everyone I talk to has a strong opinion on his guilt/innocence. You know, my first take is this was a pretty popular podcast, Serial, and of course there's been other reporting, including our own reporting. I still think you're going to find a solid number of people in Baltimore who have not heard a single thing about the case who can come in and be objective. And then second, there's a lot of Supreme Court precedent. There's a case, Irvin versus Dowd, that says you don't need absolute ignorance for people to be impaneled as jurors. And so what probably would happen is, assuming there aren't enough jurors with lack of knowledge, for the most part, as long as a prospective juror says, you know, I've heard some reporting on it, but I'm willing to put those preconceived notions aside and decide the case based on the evidence, that's probably good enough. And so I think that if this case goes to a third trial, you can probably get a fairly neutral jury. And I think question 20 is just sort of a throwing the hat under. That's something we need to really address.
Yeah, the last question.
You can do that.
My,
yeah, sorry. Yeah,
my internal rant. My KG at Kata811. Please help me with this. How can someone be granted a new trial twice, cleared of all charges, and still be incarcerated? This baffles me. What are we missing? Well, I did explain earlier. It's not so much that he was cleared of all charges, and I actually tweeted something that made it sound like it was. So I apologize for that. The convictions have been vacated. The charges have not been dropped. They still stand. Still be incarcerated. Well, this is literally how the system works. What I have learned in my experience over these 19 years as somebody who's not practiced criminal defense law is that once a state has your conviction, they fight tooth and nail to keep that conviction. And so we just have to keep pushing through it. And, you know, but I think we're getting closer than we've ever been, basically. And so it's all going in the right direction. So hang in there, folks. I know I am.
Thanks so much to all of our listeners for tuning in for this second update episode on the Adnan Syed case. We'll be back on April 23rd to pick up a new case involving Pam Lanier out of North Carolina. So we'll see you back in a couple of weeks.
A big thank you to attorney Erica Souter for joining us this week on Undisclosed for this bonus episode. A thank you to Mithil Thelhan, our awesome executive producer, for making it happen week after week. Thank you, Baluki, for our logo. Chrissy, thank you for the website. A big thank you to Rebecca Lavoy, our audio producer and host of Crime Writers on, one of my favorite podcasts. And thank you to all of our listeners and sponsors. Thanks for bringing us back week after week. Make sure you check us out online. Follow us on social media. Our handle is @UndisclosedPod. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. See you guys next week.